principles, and if there's anything that I'd love for you to grab a hold of, is the importance of the principles before we get to how-tos. I do want to allow for significant time for how-tos, especially if, if you're a church leader, and then also if you're doing, like, how do you do that? How do you build that into your rhythm for raising funds? But then also, if you're meeting with the donor one-on-one, what are some things that you can think about doing? Because there's some pre-work, there's during work, and there's post-work. It's absolutely critical. And I'll just say this. I'm leading this not because I'm a professional fundraiser. I'm not, but I am a pastor. And one of the myths is that, you know, once you get out of the church planting phase, that you stop fundraising. Like, we're always fundraising. It's because, as we'll find out later, it's not about raising funds. It's about raising disciples. Mm-hmm. And we're about making disciples, and funds are a key part of that. So church planters spend, 21% of their time raising funds. They don't think they're getting into church planting to be a fundraiser, and yet that's exactly what happens with about 25% of their time. And it's just reality. But then the myth is that once you become an existing church, self-sustaining, self-governing, self-replicating, that the fundraising bug goes away. It doesn't. We're always going to be fundraising, and it's going to be fun. What I want to do, though, is just, I've read a number of books, but what's been most helpful for me is contextualizing some of those principles to our context. So I would encourage you to do the same. But here's some challenges that I want to present to you, because I want to give you the bad news first before I give you the good news. And it's right there on the sheet. And think about, as you hear these things, like, how would you respond? Like, what would you do in light of these statistics? If you're a church planter, 3/4 of church planters say finances are one of the top 2 or 3 things they are concerned about. 1/3 say they have considered quitting ministry because of finances. And I think that's pretty conservative. From the conversations that I've had, it's a little bit higher than that. Number 3, we don't go into church planning to be fundraisers, and yet church planning spends 21% of the time on finances. Now, whether you're an existing church or a church plant, here's some of the, and you can start filling in the blanks if you'd like to do this. But current generations are giving less than previous generations. Less than 5% of millennials tithe to a church or nonprofit, compared to 50% of the elders. Elders being 70 plus. Now, I want to say this about millennials and Gen Z. I respect that generation. It's significant what the Lord is doing through the younger generation. And I share these things not to put down any generation. I come from Gen X, and I would say we got immeasurably more problems than Gen Z or the millennials do. Because one of the great benefits of the millennials and Gen Zs is just the cause-driven that at least my generation wasn't about. There's a greater care for the poor, greater care for social justice, greater care for equity. There's greater care across the board. And what we'll see is that their idea of generosity is different than somebody who's in the Gen X builder or elder generation. So if we're thinking about things, we got to think things in regards to cause-oriented, which is going to present some problems if we think that we're going to be able to create a self-sustaining budget just purely by passing the plate every Sunday morning. That's not going to happen. Doing your pledge drive, it won't work. And if it's working for you now, it's because you have a church of about 50, 60, 70 plus. But it won't work with the younger generation. Here's another challenge. Current generations have less money to give, saddled with higher debt and a higher cost of living. And I know that's not true in Hawaii. You guys have a super low cost of living. Yeah. It's practically free there, isn't it?
Just
live on the beach, fish.
Current generations have less of a steady income. I thought this was fascinating. By the way, this is all from Barna. 53 million freelancers in America today. Now, let me ask you a question. Actually, let me ask you after this. 1 out of every 2 will be freelancers by 2020, which we're in. This came out, I think that's 2050. Regardless, it's a lot of people. The trend is upwards towards freelancers. How would that impact people's generosity if the percentage of freelancers is going up?
Irregular income.
Totally.
Unreliable income.
Yep.
Unreliable tax situation, oftentimes.
Maybe even higher taxed in general. Could be, depends on how things go.
Yep. And they're saving up during feast seasons mm-hmm. in order to prepare for famines.
Most of them are startups themselves.
Yeah, and they're vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. I would say a lot of them aren't saving up during feast season, and that's problematic. That's something that, and that's four generations that's been going on. Hey, we'll put this little piece of the pie away, but we're not necessarily saving for that big whatever.
Yep. But it is a different dynamic. If somebody grew up in the Great Depression, post-World War II, where there was less resources, it trains the mentality to think about resources in a different way
mm-hmm.
versus growing into a season, a culture of more plenty. Yeah. All right. View of generosity. Again, this isn't slamming any one generation or another. I'm just saying this is a dynamic that Barna has come up with, which has implications for how we respond. The elder generation, 70-plus, view serving and volunteering. One of the top two ways that you can be generous. The elder generation will say serving and volunteering. 52% would say that to be generous means that it means to be serving and volunteering. 29% will say donating money is a way to be generous, as the two most important components to living generously. Millennials view generosity accordingly. Emotional support, 31%. Serving and volunteering, 30%. Showing hospitality, 21%. Donating money, 13%. So the elder generation has the top two values of what it means to live a generous life: volunteering and sacrificially giving. So that's going to have implications. The millennials, donating money, only 13% would say that that's one of the top two ways. Again, I would say because it's really easy to slam that, but I would say there's a reason behind it. They're thinking things more holistically mm-hmm. instead of just through one or two lanes. So there's a problem to that, but there's also a gift in that. So, you can see how older. And this could be a problem within congregations, how older Christians view millennials as being less generous. It's not hard to see why. Young people prioritize vulnerability and openness to others over financial giving. Here's a couple other statistics. And think in terms of how you are collecting funds with your congregation. Tithers only make up 10 to 15% of any congregation. 8 out of 10 people who give to churches have zero credit card debt, which means the majority of your people are giving, eight out of 10, the majority of your people that are giving have 0% debt, and the number of people that are in debt is skyrocketing. What does that mean?
Fewer people.
Exactly. And that trend is going to continue. 1/3 of Americans pay the minimum of their credit card every month. On average, Christians give 2.5% of their income to churches. 73% of church giving happens throughout the week. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tip my cards a little bit, but what does that mean in regards to how we need to think about contributions?
Online.
Exactly. Yep.
You mean not on Sunday?
Correct.
75% of giving is not on Sunday.
73%. Happens, throughout the week on a non-Sunday day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reoccurring givers annually donate 42% more than one-time donors, which if you're doing online giving or you're doing, or even an ACH, if you set up a trigger where you're doing it on a regular, that's good. 39% of smartphone owners, now think about the implications of this, 39% of smartphone owners use their phone to pay a bill in the last month. Now how does that, what are the implications for us in regards to giving then? If that's how they're paying their bills, that's also how they're going to give to the church. It's called the Amazon dynamic. It's one-click pay. The easier it is, the more accessible it is, the more that we'll do it. I'm going to keep moving. Mobile giving donations have increased by 205% in 2015. 74% of Americans write no more than one check every month. And I look at our basket, we send it around every Sunday, and I look at it when the offerings come forward, and I look in there, and I'm thinking, how are we going to be able to pay the rent this month?
That's literally the only check my family writes is a tithe check.
Yeah, and you're rare.
We don't even own checks.
You see?
I work at a bank. We don't offer checks.
Yeah.
You have to ask for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a different world. Now, your last one. About 80% of Americans carry 50% cash or less, which also means that you're not going to see a lot of you're not going to see checks or cash in the offertory basket. So if we're operating off of a previous generation mindset, it's not going to work. We got to shift. I want to ask you guys a question. This comes from the God Ask book. If you had a lever that you could pull right now that would magically provide for your budget over the next 5 years, would you pull it?
Depends on how.
Huh?
Depends on how. Means what does that look like?
Okay. Talk about that.
So of course this is, we don't deal with magic, but if it's done in a way that is engaging discipleship and forming the people, and it's because the people are getting on board, then absolutely. But not any other way.
Okay. All right. Question is, if I could just pull this lever right here, and my budget for the next 5 years would be covered. Wouldn't have to worry about it. Wouldn't have to fundraise. Would you pull it? Be honest.
Yes.
Everyone's honest.
For my church, I totally would.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a heartbeat. I love that church.
Well, then we could use the money to go out and disciple more.
Yeah.
If we weren't constantly worrying about, are we going to be here?
Right.
It's the lottery.
I would appeal to you to say, don't pull it.
Yeah.
It's a discipleship issue.
It's a discipleship issue.
Yeah.
It is, indeed.
Yeah. And we miss that opportunity. But I would probably pull it too. Just to be honest.
Do both.
Huh?
You do both.
Do both.
It's very tempting.
Right.
How long do we have to pray over that?
Right. You kind of pull and you pray as you go. You're just waiting. You're like, what's going to happen?
Accidentally bump into it.
Jesus, see what happened?
All right, now I want to get into some principles. Yeah. The gospel is the primary motivation for fundraising. The gospel is the primary motivation for fundraising. Just as he who was rich became poor, so that we are poor who could become rich. That has got to be the motivation of everything we do in regards to fundraising. It is so easy, and Ashley Noel has done a great job of pulling that out. Our work is not about works. It's about the work that he's already done. We have to continue to apply the gospel to our hearts. I have an image, but I don't know if we're going to be able to do it on this whole thing. I don't even have markers. But maybe I can do it on the back of the sheet here. Just do it the old-fashioned way. And so I have 6 kids, and I see this in my kids. We are so prone to move away from the gospel. One of my favorite things that our kids love to do is on Fridays, we like to go to Circle K, and I give them a slushy as a reward for finishing the week. And it's just something like daddy and daughter day. This is what we do. We go to Circle K and buy slushies. And I can't tell you the number of times I'll give my 8-year-old her slushie, and it's the big old thing, because it doesn't matter what size you get, it's always 99 cents. Mm-hmm. So she always gets the biggest size possible. It's this big. I'm thinking, okay, you're going to be amped up on sugar for the next 8 hours. But I'll pour it for her. I'll pay for it. I'll give it to her. We get into the car. I turn around and I say, Hope, can I have a sip? She says, no. Sip. Are you kidding me? I paid for that. I gave it to you as a gift. You have this massive amount of slurp and you're not going to give me a sip. And she says, no, it's mine. The first time she said that, and I thought, man, that is just that's my human condition. That I receive gifts, good gifts, from the hand of a good God. And he so graciously gives those things to me for the purpose of stewarding them to give to others. But how often do I just, the longer I hold on to something, the more I think it's mine. And so for us as leaders within our congregations, we have to continue to communicate that the gospel is the motivation for generosity. It's not about meeting the budget. It's not about, accomplishing our vision. It's about the gospel. That's got to be the motivation. The thing I was going to show you is basically it's a me see it. It's just basically a square, but it illustrates the point. CP means church planter, or just put pastor there. When we're doing fundraising, typically, where do we want to start? So here it is, top corner here is father, pastor, vision, budget. Typically, as a pastor, where do we want to start? When we're thinking about 2020, meeting the budget, where do we typically want to start?
Want to start with the budget. That's our temptation.
Exactly. And it's my temptation as well. But notice what happens. If I don't meet the budget, then I feel like a failure in regards to accomplishing the vision. And if I feel like a failure as a pastor, then I feel like I'm also inconsequential in the eyes of my Heavenly Father. And what the gospel says is that it begins with God's gracious initiation. He's given us an identity that is rock solid, that is irreducible, and is not dependent upon whether the vision happens or not, or whether the budget happens or not. We get our identity from the Father. He's called us. There's a first calling as a child of the King. There's a second calling as a pastor or a treasurer or whatever. He's given us a vision to accomplish, and then the resources to be able to accomplish the vision. If we go this way, this is Christianity. This is the gospel. If we go the other way, that's paganism, because it's based on works. Now, that's going to be the longest principle, but it's the most important principle, I believe. All right, second principle is that making disciples is the goal of fundraising, not raising money. If money is our country's number one idol, this is the most spiritual thing that we can do for our people. There is such a temptation to hold on to our resources. Our treasurer came up to me in 2018, and he said, Billy, our average attendance grew by 39%, and the number of households that have given has only grown by 13%. So from there, we put together a vision to figure out how we can get more people involved in the giving process. But we started by saying that this is a discipleship issue. This isn't a budget issue. Now, what do you think is going to be problematic when you tell your people that generosity is not a budget issue, but it's a discipleship issue?
Oh, imagine there's clutching of the pearls. What are you asking? What from me? I would imagine.
Do you think they're going to, well, some may believe you, but some may not.
Mm-hmm.
It could feel manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
The holy lingo, just to kind of get what you really want.
Yeah. There's all sorts of mantras out there. Mantras, I think, are very important. Like, you know, we want to increase our setting capacity, not our seating capacity, for justification for becoming a larger building. We do that. And that's one of our mantras that we picked up from somebody. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you can throw out there. But the temptation is that people hear that and they can feel manipulated. So I just want to call that out and recognize that as a dynamic.
Yeah.
Any other pushbacks on that? Any other thoughts?
Well, I mean, sin puts it back on us, right? I mean, so I know there's a certain generation that will give when there's an achievable goal. You know, when there's something they can see. We've built the gym. We've built the sanctuary. They'll give into that all day long because they can see the result because it's out there.
Yeah.
And when you're talking discipleship, you're talking here. You know, you want to go there.
Yeah. So let me ask you, if when we think about it at being discipleship issue, who do we typically think of first?
The parishioner?
Yes. Who should it start with?
Us, absolutely.
If you haven't read the book, The Spirituality of Fundraising by Henry Nouwen, it's the best book on fundraising. And he calls this out. If I have a problem going to a donor and talking with them over lunch about the vision that we believe God's given us and an invitation for them to give, if I have a problem, that's not a budget issue, it's a discipleship issue, and it begins with my heart. And I will confess, like, so we have in our congregation people that are pretty close to billionaires. And we have people that are on the streets, very socioeconomically diverse. If I look at any, and James calls this out, if I look at any person differently than the other person, then again, that's a discipleship issue with me. If I see somebody who, if I use their name, you would know who they were, and they pass by me every Sunday. If I see that person walking by and I gravitate towards them
mm-hmm.
while I'm talking to a homeless person,
mm-hmm.
because I realize that the vision that I have for our church in the next 5 years, they could pull that lever and make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
If my heart gravitates towards them, the problem isn't with them. The problem's with me. Money is a discipleship issue, and it begins with me. It begins with you. So ask yourself, if you have a problem asking for money, ask why. What is going on inside of your heart that makes that so difficult? Also, out of the God Ask book, I gotta look at this. So he has a basic triangle, and you have God, you have the pastor, and then you also have the supporter. And what he has is we as a pastor have two responsibilities. One is to ask God to provide, but then also go to the donor and give them an invitation into the work that God has invited you into. The donor also has an ask, and that ask is to the Lord, for the Lord to show them what God is calling them and how God is calling them to use their resources in service for the kingdom. So everybody has a God ask. And the planter or the treasurer or the person that's in charge of development has two. One to the Lord for provision and one to the donor for provision. Okay? All right. I want to highlight that. That's super important. All right, number three, mindset for fundraising is servanthood. Servanthood, as we see in Philippians chapter 2. It's all about going into a situation with the heart of a servant. Which means that before we ask for money, we know where their heart is. Asking questions about needs, objectives in their life, challenges. What are the things that they're passionate about? What are the things that God has already invited them into? Now, right now, I'm particularly speaking of people that are individuals, but that's super important. What is the work that God has already called them into? What are the challenges that the Lord is speaking? It is so exciting talking about this, because asking for money gives us a platform to engage in relationship. So it's all about a servant mindset. Now, I will say that you will come across times where people just outright tell you, no, I'm not going to give to your work. How we are to respond as a servant is utterly different than how oftentimes the world responds. And this comes from the book Rare Leadership. A good leader absorbs the pain of an organization while projecting joy and blessing. A bad leader absorbs the blessing of an organization while projecting pain. That's the difference between a servant and a megalomaniac, or one who lords it over. A servant absorbs the pain, absorbs the needs and the challenges of the person that you're talking to, even as you're projecting blessing. And the blessing that you're offering them is an opportunity to participate in the kingdom of God. So, having the mindset of a servant. I'm not going to spend much time on this, but the result of fundraising is joy. Results of fundraising is joy. This comes out of the paradox of generosity. And this is what they say. Generosity is associated with the release of oxytocin, dopamine, and endorphins. Same chemicals are released when exercising or associated with happiness. Conversely, those who don't give have an average higher level of stress hormone cortisol, which is linked to headaches, stroke, and depression. Living a self-indulgent life will kill you. And that's true. I'm going to skip number five because I want to come back to that. The only thing I want to say about actually number five is vision is linked to fundraising. From my experience, the longer that your church has been in existence, how can I say this?
Just say.
Well, I'm thinking about the words. Like, the more feasible it is to have a longer vision. So we've been in existence for 19 years. We just launched a 5-year goal, or a 5-year vision called the Great Work. The Great Work, and we have 3 goals. To reverse the numerical shift of those that are leaving the church, 500 baptisms, and everyone participating in the kingdom of God. So under those 3 goals, we wanted to raise $200,000 over the course of Advent season. But the ask was associated with the vision. But the reason why we were able to put a 5-year vision to it is because we're an existing church of about 19 years. If you were a church plant, I would not go longer than 1 year. When you're more established, even year 5, then you can go to a 3-year vision. Now, why do I say that? If I'm a church plant and I cast a 5-year vision, how could that be problematic? Or if I'm kind of shaky as an organization, I'm a relatively new organization, why would that be problematic?
You got to be sure you're going to be there that long.
Yeah.
You got to have some history to encourage your future.
Totally.
Not making benchmarks.
So what would you say along that same vein?
So it becomes more nebulous the further out you get, and if it's not as tangible, people are going to be less incentivized to give. Yep. Yeah.
I'm sorry. What would you say along that same vein to a church? Diane, plug your ears. Like ours, that is semi-stagnant. I mean, we have had a few people come in over the last year, but in all honesty, I've been at that particular church 2 years. I haven't heard a whole lot about, I mean, I get it, we get our budget annually, we get our budget, this is what it is, but I haven't heard a whole lot about what our vision is for that.
That's the problem.
And that's the problem.
That's the problem.
Simple as that.
Can I answer to that? Vestry talked about that last month.
Well, I'm not on Vestry.
I know, but I mean, but we talked about it last month, how we're going to present it to you. We did not want to bring it up at the annual meeting.
No, I'm not
so
saying...
So it's going to be brought up at the...
Right, and that would be a great first step.
Yeah.
That would be a great first step.
We are working on
that. Yeah, no, that's good to recognize and be aware of it. If you look at the cycle of it, of life expectancy, or life, the life cycle of a church, if a church begins to plateau and there's no vision, it's going to inevitably go down. The only way to kickstart something really is through 3 things. Is the way you create momentum is by having a vision, a leader that inculcates the vision, and then you have to have programs that are clear, that connect the vision, that allow the vision to take place. I mean, creating momentum is simple as that. Vision, the leader that can execute it, and then programs that will allow you to accomplish your vision. So I'm gonna run through a little bit of an exercise in regards to vision. Number 6, the currency for fundraising is trusting relationships. If there are 4 things that I could highlight in regards to fundraising, really it all comes down to this. Number 1 is trusting relationships. Number 2, clear vision and strategy. Number 3, engaged oversight that is also trusted. And number 4, the church planter or leader having a heart of gratitude. I mean, if I could just dial everything down, this whole presentation, down to those 4 things, that's what it would be. But anyways, the first is a trusting relationship. The second is a vision, and vision that is not pie in the sky by and by. And also an engaged oversight or a trusted oversight as well. And then lastly, gratitude or thanksgiving, because power's on the backside, not on the front side. This goes to a little bit of how to have a conversation with a donor one-on-one. And I'm just going to tip my cards now and just tell you, when I have a conversation with a donor, I'll do my research ahead of time. I'll find out what motivates them. What are their objectives in life? If it's a foundation, like what are they passionate about? What do they give to? Some foundations give to structures, bricks and mortar. Some foundations give to people. You got to find out what is their vision statement, what's their purpose statement, what are they passionate about, and you identify the aspect of your vision that complements that. So do your research going in. Not only the research of studying the person that you're meeting with, but also through prayer. When you meet, what I have found, the higher level of the trusting relationship, the lower amount of time that you need to spend actually casting vision. The times that I've asked a donor for money, I cannot think of a time where I've spent longer than 5 or 7 minutes talking about the vision. The last conversation that I had with somebody, we were meeting for lunch. 95% of the time, I was asking them questions, finding out more about them. And I know them pretty well, but we're engaging in relationship. And then at some point in the conversation, we all had our meal, we're all satisfied, and we're connecting, and I talked for approximately 5 minutes. Not even 5 minutes. If it was 5 minutes, I'd be surprised. And I stopped, and I shut up, and I said, "So what do you think?" They said, "Well, let us pray about it." And I said, "So when can I get back to you? And would we give you enough time? 4 days? 2 weeks?" And they said, "Get back to us in 5 days." So I reached back out to them in 5 days, and they said we would like to do for the thing that we're engaged in. They said we'll give you $400,000 on the front end right now, and then we're going to commit another $1.2 million. Now that conversation literally was over a 5 minute talk on vision. 95% of the time we were talking about relationship. Now what allowed that to take place? Years and years and years of relationship building. And Dave, you know this probably better than anybody, like in terms of your job before with the bank, and, mm-hmm. and what made you so effective at your job is you had trusting relationships with people. It's the same within the church. So, okay. Along this line, this is a pet peeve of mine. Don't negotiate. Dude, it's disingenuous. If you're asking for this amount of money because you need this amount of money and you'll be held accountable for this amount of money, they want to know, anybody that is going to be generous, they want to know they donate X amount, they want to see this kind of fruit. So ask for ask for what you need. Don't over-ask in the expectation that they're going to come down or half you. Just don't negotiate. Just ask for what you need. Lastly, fundraising is a marathon, not a sprint. This is a lifelong opportunity. Actually, lastly, all things in gratitude. What I do want to say about this, some of you guys have seen this, is that I believe that vision is more compelling on the backside, not the front side. Somebody can get up and say, "We're going to plant 5 wells in Rwanda." And everybody goes, "Yeah, we're going to plant 5 wells in Rwanda." Some money comes in, some trickle comes in, and people are like, "We're going to plant 5 wells." You keep communicating it. And eventually you get the resources. The most important thing to do is after the resources have come in, you go to Rwanda, you get the footage of the wells being drilled, you take it back to the congregation, you write handwritten notes, don't send out a general email of saying, "We're so grateful for the people that have given to this thing, and here's the video." Do the video, do the handwritten notes, and celebrate the tar out of it. Because the next time you cast vision, your effectiveness in 2.0 will be determined by how much you are grateful and are thankful in 1.0. So gratitude. All right, any thoughts? I went through those kind of quick. I think I'm going to throw the principles. Yeah. Any thoughts? I'll just say real quick. I'm going to do this later. We had a goal of raising $200,000 during the Advent season. We raised $217,000. And what we found is the general giving didn't go down. General giving went up. Last year, we did not do a particular campaign, a designated campaign. And December went up like we thought, but it didn't touch what we did this past December. Every year that we've done a designated gift, it has incentivized general giving.
What was your general gift for this Advent?
300 and something.
Oh, no, you didn't have like a, "We're going to use this money for something." It was just...
The general?
Yeah.
That was just going to go to this our budget.
Okay.
Yeah, so like $324,000 came in for just general. But that was like, last December, like $200 or something.
Okay.
So
then explain to me what you mean by designated gift, because as a layperson, I'm thinking that is your 5 wells in Rwanda.
That is the designated gift.
Okay, that's what we're saying.
Yeah. Which leads to what I want to say in regards to vision. Okay, how to raise funds. Oh, I know what I want to say about that. So I don't know how many. It was in the triple digits. So our communications director came to me and he said, "All right, we're going to send an email blast and to thank people." And I was preparing actually this talk for church planters. And I thought, we can't do it. We can't send out an email blast. We got to handwrite those notes. So I don't know how many hundred or hundreds of thank you notes I wrote. And it was just like a long, like it wasn't just like thank you so much. It was like a couple paragraphs of just thanking them for their incredible generosity. But that is so important. The more personalized the touch, do that when you're fundraising. Okay, how to raise money. I want to speak to first. I'm sorry, I'm doing so much talking. I want to, like, any questions at this point?
I think, I don't know how many of us have kind of looked over, like, I know Bishop Ken has, like, a little article, you know, he's written on giving. I don't know where everybody's at necessarily with their thoughts on the kind of the background theology and doctrine of giving and discipleship, but at what point in time is it necessary to re-educate, I mean, to disciple your people to understand and how frequently do you do that? I mean, not in the sense of give, but in the sense of why we give.
Mm-hmm.
To why we give, but why we are inviting them to be a part of that as well.
Yeah.
To understand behind it what is there. What does that look like when it comes to linking those together?
Well, I'd love to hear from other people. I can tell you two or three things we've done. In our membership class, mm-hmm. we communicate what we do, what our expectations are, and why our expectations. We also do what we call kingdom moments, where we put in the offertory spot, where it's just an opportunity for us to communicate what we're doing here and why we're doing it. We're not very highly liturgically, but we're pretty low liturgical, but we create space that can explain different parts, not like an instructed Eucharist, but basically we're like a gateway drug for people that are on the Canterbury Trail coming into liturgical worship. So we do those highlights. Also, we preach pretty regularly because vision's a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
We always lead with vision. We lead with what we're going towards and why we're doing it, which speaks to purpose and mission. So I always couple it with vision and mission.
Okay.
Why? Yeah.
It's kind of the external.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then why wouldn't you give? I mean, this isn't another mantra. We don't want something from you. We want something for you.
Right.
But yeah, that's the idea. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody else has some thoughts or ideas of what you guys have done to keep the why before people, or just like a theology of generosity.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
For us, I mean, so we're a church plant launching on March 1st, and we've been meeting as a core group for about a year and a half, 2 years. It's kind of, we kind of had a start and then a restart, sort of. I mean, and for us, it's been kind of like quarterly, we'll sort of have kind of family meetings where we just like review lots of stuff and just share and ideas and things. And we always touch on giving then and the why behind it. And then I think similarly, like on, you know, various Sundays, like it oftentimes relates so well to the lectionary and to the scripture we're reading. So it's become a pretty natural part of like our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see what that looks like for us as we like launch and grow. But I almost think it's been easier as a core group of people. But it's also but it's been such a big part of how we discipled our group too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know for us, we didn't always do this, or at least I don't think they've always done it. When I first came, we didn't do it. But after the offering was given, was a piece of liturgy
mm-hmm.
that we recite every Sunday now. We started just before Advent, I think. I can't remember what he says, but all the people say, "And of your own have we given you."
Huh.
And that's it's a reminder, week in and week out.
It's great.
It's from what you've given us that we're giving. And I think that's been, for me anyway, that's built. This repetition back in.
That's beautiful.
Sweet.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah, because how you talk about it,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, that people come in, especially I think, as I've seen in our Anglican churches, we get a lot of people from other different backgrounds and traditions, and that they bring with them, right, their baggage and their teaching.
Right.
And
good, bad, or indifferent, right?
Right. And so, I just think to ground people in the gospel, like you said, because at the end of the day, it's about the gospel.
Yes.
So you reflect it in your own church giving, right? How we as a church give, but you're inviting them, individuals and families, to follow that same model, right?
Mm-hmm.
To to give. And so, you know, it surprises me that, you know, with it being such an idol in our society,
mm-hmm.
and being in such an epidemic in the churches, that, I mean, it really is a discipleship issue, both at the church level and the individual issue. It seems like something that should be a pretty heavy, you know, conversation regularly, because they need it, right?
They need it.
We need it if we're not following it, but certainly they need it, and maybe they don't know they need it.
Yeah.
So.
And there's also some educational part, just because of the increased debt, and there is a dynamic taking place in our culture right now,
mm-hmm.
that I think there is a responsibility on the church's part to be able to teach into that and to walk alongside of people in that.
I noticed a difference this year. He actually, in November, I don't know if you guys remember, he actually did a sermon all about why we give and all that kind of stuff. And then when it came time for the pledge cards, I noticed a big difference from the last couple of years to this year.
And I'll speak to that.
Because of the way he presented it this year.
Mm-hmm.
We did not sign a pledge card the previous year specifically because our priest had not ministered to us regarding it. And as my family is a very high church family. Our church is somewhere in the mid-range of high church. So we expect our priest to take a role. So if you're in the priesthood or the diaconate, know that there are people out there that are expecting you to have two things that are the hardest things to preach on, is familial roles between a husband and a wife and money. And if you cannot do those with some sort of certainty, you're not leading your sheep properly. I'm sorry. That's just putting a fine point on it. And so we specifically prayed over our pledge card the year before and said, we cannot pledge without a clear vision.
Mm-hmm.
So when he finally did do that, we did do that. And what we wrote on our pledge card, we know in our hearts, we'll probably give above and beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, but without that vision. And so we heard it. Loud and clear. We're glad for it.
Yeah, that's good.
I saw a big difference from the couple years before and this
well,
time.
And I think
yeah.
we come from a unique spot of having a congregation that had to lead themselves for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and my family comes from a place where we were at the end of a capital campaign to build the building.
Yeah.
When we physically left one location and came to Cheyenne, and that was painful to
mm-hmm.
watch. And I was actively participating in that capital campaign, being a teacher for the 20-year-olds. Got my children involved. My daughter literally baked cinnamon rolls and raised $5,000 off of cinnamon rolls.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, stuff like that for things that they wanted. But somebody spoke to them about her vision. She said, what do you want? She went, I want a youth room. A room where I can get together with other peers. Okay, what are you going to do? I can make cinnamon rolls. Okay. You know, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And how old is she?
She, at the time, was 13.
Yeah, see, there's something significant. I mean, that's really special. You're personalizing it, and it's coming from the mouth of a child.
Yeah.
That's motivating.
That's huge.
I want to highlight two things in regards to how. One for churches, and then one as you're just engaging one-on-one with somebody. And for the church, it's pretty simple, but I want to land on the last one. First, preach on money, and be unashamedly preaching on money. Does anybody not do any kind of online giving here? Okay. I would encourage you to get online giving. Now, one of the pushbacks people have is what about the fees?
Yeah, and that's, I brought it up at our vestry, and that's what they hit me with. And so I've talked to the bank, and I'm working on that, but I haven't.
What you gain outpaces what you
mm-hmm,
lose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So
oh, yeah.
if I'll, you can tell them that you went to a fundraising thing, this is what the person said, so you can blame me. If they don't do it, you don't have a future.
That's what I'm afraid of.
So I'll just say,
I've been looking at it, but I just haven't.
Go to online giving. There's other ways.
Okay.
You don't have to necessarily do a credit card. You can do a debit card. You can also set it up to where
ACH,
you don't accept
ACH
would be a
that's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's no fees associated with that or very minimal.
Very minimal.
Very minimal.
And I can help you with
And then if they're against, if you know, if it's a Dave Ramsey thing and they're against your credit cards, you can just set it up where it's just debit card. Planning Centers, but it's a platform we use. It's the superior one. And our,
what do you call it?
Planning Center. It's we like it.
We use Tidely. It's because it also has statements and everything built in. Mm-hmm.
Tidely?
Yeah. It's very reasonable.
45 to 50% of the money that came in for us was online giving.
Wow.
So number three, remain relational. And that not only in regards to if they give, but even if they don't give. I can't tell you the number of times I've asked people for money, they don't give. Remain relational.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth time, fifth time. We have somebody that's been a part of Wellspring for 12 years, and they just gave their first check in December. Mm-hmm. And I've been in a relationship with him, with that family, but with him in particular, for 12 years. Don't give up. Remain relational. When you want to remove yourself from that relationship and say, I can, you know, don't do it. Remain relational. Also, that goes to the Thanksgiving, the more personalized, this goes to your point, the more personalized you can make it, the better. My church planting coach, Bob Logan, he said one of the things that he and his wife used to do is that he would send thank you notes, but then his wife would write a little prayer for their church that their child could pray.
Mm-hmm.
So that the child, who's maybe like in second grade, would read that prayer at the dinner table. Now what's happening is Bob Logan is getting the children, the child involved in the disciple-making process, for teaching them to pray for and live into a sacrificial, generous lifestyle. And then anytime he went to a different part of the world or the country, he would pick up a little trinket and then send that with a thank you note to that child. So the more personalized you can make those things, the better. Remain relational. Lastly, have a vision. Now I'll just, this is really like, this is another day teaching in terms of how to cast vision. I want to keep it real simple. But if you have just a project, not even necessarily a vision per se, but a project, maybe it's a drilling a freshwater well, I'm launching Alpha, planting a church, moving from this space to another, doing something as you're reaching out to the community, even if it's a small thing. Say, we want to raise $5,000. I mean, start small. Or we want to raise $1,000. If you're just starting out, put forth a vision to the community and say, we have a goal of raising this amount for this project. And this is here's our objectives for that goal. Here's our four things. We need 10 people involved. We need to raise this amount of money. We need to just put together some objectives. Get everybody involved. And not only will they lead with their money, but they will also lead with their person. Okay? That will incentivize general giving. It will move things along. So, have a vision. If you are meeting with somebody one-on-one, let's say you're doing a parachute plant in Maui, for example, here's some things you can do. There's a whole sorts of books, people raising, friend raising, in terms of how to. So I'm not going to go into great depth, but this is just what I found. You know, they recommend, you know, you get a list of everybody that's in the area, and then after you talk with them, you ask them, do you have any friends that I can talk with? I think that's helped. I've never had a whole lot of success with that. I have had success with just identifying names of people within my sphere of influence and then talking to them about money, but I've never been so bold as to say, do you have other friends who would be interested in getting to this? But if you have a vision that's particular, say, you've heard my vision. If you know anybody that also shares the same kind of passion,
yeah,
would you pass this on? Which means that you need something that's portable. You could just hand them to say, this is what we're about, and just keep it before the people. But this is what I would do in terms of practices of fundraising. Before the meeting, you pray. It's interesting to me, Nehemiah, before he had a vision, he had a burden. And after he had a burden, he responded in prayer. Before he cast a vision about building the wall, he prayed. And before he prayed, he had a burden. The reason why you're at where you're at is because you got a burden. So pray into that burden. And as you pray into that burden, God will bring to you to mind people that you need to be talking to about this vision. And pray about those meetings. Pray before the meetings. Second, I've already alluded to it, but review the person, church, or organization that you're going to go see. Again, some people value buildings, some people value people, some people value programs. What do they value? I can tell you. What are their guidelines? The Diocese of the Rocky Mountains, we have certain guidelines by which we determine how we give funds. If you're a church planter and you're in the Diocese of the Rocky Mountains and you're applying for funds, ask me for the manual, because in the manual we'll have the guidelines. You make your plea, you develop your grant request based upon those guidelines, because that's how we determine where the monies go. Tipping my cards and telling you what to do. But that's the point, is you find out what the guidelines are of the organization. Our number one supporter of our church planting network is the Baptists. It's not Anglican.
What?
It's a Southern Baptist.
Tell me how that works out. Please explain that
because,
to me.
Because we have, well, number one, we have a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, we know what they're trying to do, and we know the goals that they have. So we've aligned with that relationship. We've said, we also share these same goals. Would you be interested in giving? And they said, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
They've given to our network over between $200,000 and $300,000.
So you go into Baptist churches and ask for funding for planting Anglican churches, and they're all on board?
Well, that started out as a relationship.
That's kind of cool.
And we explored the relationship. They were developing something with church planting. Like, there's so much money out there. Do your research. Find where the networks are. Find out who's giving to church planting. Then find out what their guidelines are, what they're passionate about. And then initiate those relationships. You got to be a networker as a church planter. If you're going to see momentum, you got to be a networker. Which means you go to conferences like this, find people that you don't know, hear their story, and see where there might be a connection. All right, that's pre-work. And I'm going to go through this really quick. Okay, during the meeting, remain relational throughout the meeting. The ask should only be 3 to 7 minutes. Be clear and specific. Have your elevator speech ready to go. You have to know it so well that you can adjust it on the fly. The conversation that I had, that I told you guys about previously, I went in with one way I was going to say it, but I changed it to another based upon the conversation that we were having. So know your speech so well that you're willing to be flexible and adapt through it. If you don't plan, the only thing that you can do is ad lib. But if you plan, you have the freedom to be to both live according to your plan, but then also ad lib. Don't negotiate. Ask how you can follow up and when. That's how you close it. Just say, I'm going to give you some, because most people are going to want to go away and pray. As you go away and pray, how much time do you need? When can I follow up with you? They give you a time, and then follow up. If they say 3 days, call them in 3 days and say, Fred, you know, we had that great conversation. Have you had time to pray for it? What is the Lord leading you to give? So follow up with them. And then regardless, if they say we're not going to give any money, a bunch of money, less than you thought, thank you, thank you, mm-hmm. thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Always be thankful. And lastly, after the meeting, pray for them, follow up, again, say thank you, celebrate the Thanksgiving through stories. Last thing I want to say about stories is don't idolize them. We can really we feel like we have to have a story in order to tell people to give. If you don't have a story to tell, don't tell. Don't feel the pressure to make up a story. That's idolizing a story. But if you have a story to tell, then tell the story. Does that make sense? All right.
I have a couple comments.
Yes.
I think one of the things you'll find as you start fundraising, and also when people approach you about giving money, some people may not want to give you cash or a check, but give you stocks, securities, or other things. So you have to have a plan on how to accept that, if you're going to accept that. And if you need help, talk to somebody at the diocese to help you. Very wealthy people, if they're going to make substantial gifts, will not give you cash or a check, because they give you appreciated stock instead. It's better for their taxes. And,
yeah, when we had our capital campaign, we had a lot of people giving stock and 401ks.
Right.
And, those kinds of things.
And also, the reason why elderly, if they're going to make gifts with stocks out of their IRAs, for example, there's a way to do it so that they don't have to pay the capital gains tax or the distribution tax,
right,
and can take the deduction directly. So, you know, so you have to ask somebody that knows those things.
Do you sell those right away?
Yeah, well, there's two rules of thumb.
Yeah.
Generally, you sell it right away.
Yeah.
And the reason why is that you were supposed to give them a letter explaining what the gift was and how much it was, and you take the date of the transfer and you use the average cost. The brokerage firm that you deal with, or I use TD Ameritrade, it has it online, so you can do it quickly. You don't want to be in a situation where you held on to it too long and then it goes down in value.
Mm-hmm.
And then how are you going to tell them that I didn't use all of that money because I didn't get all of the money?
Yeah, that's,
but
that's,
if you do have somebody that's experienced in your congregation, like on a large gift that we got, I held on to 4 securities because I knew those securities would go up.
Mm-hmm.
And we sold them in the next fiscal year, and we have appreciation on those securities, which is not part of the original gift, but
mm-hmm.
it went further.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you're talking to people of means, and especially if they're going to be a lead donor on something, the reason why they are where they're at is because of attention to detail. And if there isn't a clear strategy with a clear vision, they are not going to be compelled. All the more reason to have your vision crystal clear, your strategies crystal clear, and all the dots connect. One of the wealthiest people I know still will shop around for the cheapest gas station. You think, you got $1 billion, and you're saving, what, 50 cents? The reason why they're at the way they're at is because they're, well, part of it. I mean, anyways, that's the mindset. And somebody of means has been communicated with time and time again about vision. And if your vision isn't compelling, then there's all sorts of other visions that are compelling that they will give monies to. They may not, they probably won't give 10% to your congregation, especially if they're that wealthy, because they're giving to 100 different places. Yeah. Which also makes it hard to write thank you notes, actually. Because even this last one, when they're coming in from TD Ameritrade or Fidelity, you can't write thank you notes.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even necessarily know who wrote those checks, but yeah. Time has expired. I am sorry. If you have any other questions or comments, I'll stay around and would love to talk more.